Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly reminder that when it comes to politics and government, you don't have to do it that way. I am Matt Welch, joined by a late summer replacement crew. Reason Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward is here, per usual, but subbing in for those other two guys. And returning to the program are Reason TV Senior Producer Zach Weissmuller and Why We Can't Have Nice Things podcast host Eric Boehm himself. Welcome, podcasters.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Wow. Love the throwback.
Did they divvy that up in advance?
That's nice. All right, let's do this. Last week, the American political calendar was dominated by Republicans. On Wednesday, we had the first debate night of the presidential primary season, featuring eight of the top nine GOP candidates. Then on Thursday, the runaway leader of the pack, former President Donald Trump, who had opted out of the debate in favor of a softball Twitter interview with former Fox host Tucker Carlson, was arraigned in Georgia on racketeering charges, posing for a mugshot that went instantly iconic. So what do these three events, the debate, the Tucker interview, the arraignment, and the GOP electorate's response to them, tell us about the direction of the Republican Party, conservatism writ large, particularly as it concerns issues that libertarians care about? Let's start with the debate aspect. Catherine, I know you took a little bit of time in between your sailing lessons to glimpse the feisty exchanges on the stage. What is one big policy takeaway that you had from last week?
My big policy takeaway was I learned that we all agree without any controversy that we will be invading Mexico. Like, that was just casually referenced, asserted, nobody pushed back on it. Now, subsequently on social media, there has been a bunch of discourse around how we describe these proposals, and invade Mexico is indeed a controversial way of framing it. I chose it on purpose because that's what it would be. If we take a bunch of the, like, armed forces of the United States and start doing military stuff in another country, I feel like it's fair to call that an invasion. Now, of course, we would not be attempting to take Mexico's territory for our own. But the idea that somehow they started it, they being the immigrants, it was sort of bandied about on the stage. They are trying to come here with their fentanyl and their desire for jobs. How rude. We have to bomb them. This is not a good policy. This is not actually a thing that we can really do constitutionally. It's also not going to end well. And the fact that it was casually accepted by nearly everyone on the Republican stage was awfully disheartening to me.
Yeah, I think Chris Christie was one of the only ones who afterwards said that's not particularly realistic or something along.
Yeah. But even then, it was like he let it go by on stage, no problem, multiple times.
Chris Christie is one of many Republicans who over the years has been fond of suggesting that what we should do with immigrants who come into their country is to label them like FedEx packages so that we can track their movements, which is pretty great. This is not a new thing at all in this campaign. There's not just a let's use the military in Mexico, but there's a lot of day one in that. People love the day one military into Mexico. I think it's great, especially for those people who are portraying themselves as being intervention skeptics and against neocons. I'm not a neocon. Day one, Mexico, war! Eric, you write a lot about trade policy and the mathematical horrors of short and long-term deficits and debts. What did you see on those fronts during the debates?
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. And, I think a moment that probably a lot of libertarians like stood up and cheered maybe for the first time ever for South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley when she talked about the debt situation in the country and talked about how Republicans are to blame for this, too. It's not just Joe Biden and the Democrats. And so I think that was a noteworthy moment. Of course, Nikki Haley is also a neocon. I don't remember. I think I was in the middle of writing, actually, about the bit that she did on the debt when the discussion of Mexico really happened. So I don't know if she said anything significant about that, but like she's not somebody that libertarians will ever probably find themselves inclined to vote for. But I think she did make a really strong point when it came to the debt and deficit situation. And so that's something definitely worth highlighting from the debate. Overall, I thought, like, you know, it was actually more of a policy focused discussion. Not that these things ever are that in depth, but it really was kind of more of a policy oriented debate than I went into it expecting to see. So that was, you know, somewhat encouraging. One of my takeaways was like, maybe once we get Trump out of the picture, even if it's only temporarily, there actually is space for some like conservative, you know, in good and bad ways, but there is space for like conservatives to actually have a debate about policy, which is something that's been really sorely lacking on the right for like the past, you know, whatever, 8 years.
I will say that is spoken like a man who paid more attention to the very beginning of the debate and then popped away to write, because it did degrade as the debate went
that's
on
for sure.
To like a whippersnapper old man, like barkity bark between Pence and Ramaswamy, for example.
Yeah, was there was a bunch of that. Yeah, there
in-depth
was
in-depth policy analysis, I wouldn't say.
No, I wouldn't say in-depth policy analysis, but I mean, even the discussion of you know, do we have military intervention in Mexico, as completely bonkers and insane of an idea as that is, it at least represents like an actual policy idea, right? Like it actually represents some sort of a tangible thing. Now, again, a terrible idea. But if you want to discuss what do we do about fentanyl coming into America and how do we deal with the people that are dying from it, you know, that's one idea. It's a very bad one, but you know, it's an idea.
Spoken like a man who wakes up in a trench in the mud, hungover, who can at least look up and say, I think I see the sky somewhere. Catherine, is that work? Zach, you literally moved from Gavin Newsom's California to Ron DeSantis's Florida, in part at least because of COVID-related education policies. Did you see anything on COVID or Educate through 12 stuff that caught your attention?
Well, I will say that my experience moving from California to Florida was, you know, I didn't move there because DeSantis is governor of Florida. I did at the time see that as a perk because I appreciated what he did during COVID in terms of keeping the schools open, letting people make personal decisions about what to wear on their face and so forth, and what sort of treatments to take, and you know, zigging when everyone else was zagging. And I appreciated when he brought up that record. I thought that was when DeSantis was at his best. When DeSantis was at his worst, which was more often, was when he was leaning more into the culture war issues. And on the issue of education that you brought up, Matt, it's a perfect example. You know, once the issue of education was brought to him, he starts going right in on the CRT battles, kind of saying educate, you know, we need education, not indoctrination. My problem with that message is that the sense that I get from DeSantis and kind of the intellectuals behind him, the Chris Rufos of the world, is that they want their own sort of indoctrination, not a open market in education. And that's actually what has unfolded in Florida. I mean, we now have education savings accounts in Florida, which I give DeSantis credit for signing, but he didn't emphasize that in his answer. And it was actually Vivek who emphasized the power of school choice in his answer. So I wish DeSantis had answered like Vivek Ramaswamy on that answer. You know, that is, I think, you know, for parents of young children like myself, that's certainly a central issue that we're deciding on when we're evaluating these candidates.
Quick follow up on that, Zach, since you're in Florida and you can observe his record both as governor and as a person who's running for president, which can be two different personas maybe sometimes. Do you get the sense that he's doing kind of culture war nationally and then doing more kind of like nuts and bolts policy stuff locally, or is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, unfortunately, I would be happier if that were what's happening. What seems to have happened is after he won re-election, then he started pivoting both his rhetoric and his agenda towards more of a national, these national culture war issues. I mean, he famously signed into law a lower abortion ban. He is, you know, his battles with Disney, I think, are incredibly dumb and self-destructive and not beneficial to Floridians. And again, you know, the overreach on things like the Stop Woke Act, you know, it's one thing to you know, try to adjust standards for K through 12 and, you know, elementary education, but then to start imposing an ideological agenda on higher ed is just that exemplifies the sort of, the two sides of DeSantis, where he had some of these good libertarian impulses through COVID. But the other side of him is he is in this orbit of national conservatives, the Chris Rufos. And unfortunately, you know, especially during the Republican primary, that is the side that has come to the fore and is dominant.
There was that weird like social media law, too, that I feel like that's really fallen off the radar. But like that's, you know, got struck down by the courts. But that really speaks to some of this, too. Like it was a, you know, an attempt in some weird kind of backhanded way to like force free speech upon platforms by actually removing their rights to control what goes on their platforms and, you know, ran afoul of the First Amendment and Section 230 and all that stuff.
Exactly. And he's an attorney, so he knows when laws don't make sense. And I mean, I think these things are going to get struck down one by one. So to me, it again shows that this is not about advancing the governance of the state of Florida. It's about getting these things out there, regardless of whether they win or lose. And by the time they almost certainly lose, it won't matter anymore.
Catherine, let's continue to zero in on individual candidates. You're a lady. Whose performance last week did you find particularly noteworthy?
I was, as Eric mentioned earlier, Nikki Haley's first answer, combined with her double X chromosomes really, called to me. And I don't know. I know not to trust Nikki Haley. Like, I've followed her career. She is not one of us. She is not a libertarian. And her closing remarks really were like a thorn in my side, because I was kind of like vibing with Nikki Haley. She's, you know, not only did she start out with that great answer about the spending, but she also just said extremely reasonable and practical things throughout the debate, right? So she, you know, for the abortion question, she said, we do not have the votes to do a federal abortion ban. We don't have them. We're not gonna have them. We need to stop talking as if we can deliver this to the American people when we cannot. And I was like, yeah, that's right. That's true. That's correct. And she still was like, I would like to keep women from doing what they want with their bodies. But she had the air of a person and conveyed her kind of command of a person who has actually worked in politics, who's worked in, you know, getting things done. And I think that I experienced a little bit the like I would have a beer with her moment. And then I was like, no, this is what they want you to do. And then at the very end, when she just was like, by the way, in conclusion, war is awesome. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Keep that in mind. So I had a Nikki Haley moment, but it lasted maybe like the first 47 minutes of the debate. And then I was done.
She has so far in the initial post-debate polls been the candidate to bounce the most. She vaulted over not just Chris Christie, but I think even Mike Pence now. She's poking her nose ahead of him. So clearly it was resonating a little bit with some people, although, you know, polls and buyer beware and whatnot and the ghost of Stephanie Slade. Eric, speaking of the politicians who have actually been in office and have got stuff done, otherwise known as the establishment lane or the normie politicians lane, that Republican voters don't like, just don't like, haven't liked it for 8 years, not even a moment in the last 8 years.
I'm a DC girl, Matt. It can't help it. I like those people.
That literally it is 15% of the GOP presidential electorate. So talk about that lane a little bit, especially two of the other people that we haven't talked about, Mr. Vice President Mike Pence and his big defender, Chris Christie.
Yeah, really interesting, actually, that these two guys would end up kind of in the same lane or end up being sort of teammates in some regard, right, Matt? Because they are very different personalities. If you went back 10 years ago, you would have never thought these two guys would be appealing to the same section of the Republican electorate. They seem like they're, Christie in many ways is sort of a pre-Trump, you know, right? This sort of braggadocious and brash character. But now you've got these two guys, Pence and Christie, that sort of tag-teamed Ramaswamy quite a bit in the debate. We could talk about that a bit later. But I think the real thing that's happening with the way the two of them went at this debate is, I mean, this is the debate that is happening within this primary, right? Kind of the shadow debate is, what do we do about Donald Trump? What does the Republican Party do about the alleged and very obvious, the alleged criminal misdoings and the very obvious political misdoings of Donald Trump in office, and particularly in the wake of the last presidential election? Christie, I thought his strongest moment in the debate was when he said that someone has to stop normalizing this conduct. Whether or not you believe criminal charges are right or wrong, the conduct is beneath the office of the president of the United States. Very strong moment for him. Pence had a good moment, sort of an exchange with Ramaswamy over whether they would pardon former President Trump if either of them ended up, you know, having that power at some point, which I don't think either of them ever will. So it's kind of a moot debate. But Pence's response to that was that, you know, he said sort of first kind of tried to get out of it by saying, like, well, you know, you're assuming that Trump will be convicted, and I'm not sure he will be convicted. Okay, fair. But then went on to say that, you know, as governor, Pence had dealt with people who had, you know, has actually dealt with pardons before. And he said that, you know, showing contrition, showing that you're actually, you know, you realize that what you did is wrong, is important in his mind for the granting of a pardon. And that he didn't say this, but the unspoken part of that is that you don't expect Donald Trump to ever demonstrate that. And so he said he would give due consideration if it ever came across his desk. But so I think you have kind of two different approaches here from the two candidates that have staked themselves out as the most obvious kind of anti-Trump Republicans in the field. And Christie is going at it in a very kind of prosecutorial direct way. And Pence is trying to appeal to, I think, the better angels of Republican voters and say, like, look, you may disagree with what I did on January 6th. You may like Donald Trump a lot, but we need to consider, like, what is in the, you know, best interest of the country? What is in the best interest of the party? And so the way those two are handling it, I don't expect that it will do either of them any favors in the polls. I don't think either of them have much of a chance of winning this campaign. But it is kind of an interesting shadow debate or shadow primary, if you will, how they kind of go about prosecuting this case against Trump and against really the people in the party who still, you know, put their full faith and credit behind Donald Trump.
Definitely got Christie some lusty boos that had to be like a manic.
Honestly, though, like there's some, like Chris Christie deserves to be booed.
He wants,
like,
to be booed. He's from New Jersey.
He was making good points in the moment that he was being booed for the most part. Yeah. But I was still just like, you know what? Boo them all.
Yeah.
He's having a lot of fun with it, though, I think. It kind of feels like he's just enjoying it.
At one point, Ramaswamy actually said, like, hey, we're just here to have a good time or something like that. And I was like, no, I mean, we're like a little bit here to choose the leader of the free world. Like, let's... Like, I support zesty and spirited debate with a little soupçon of the devil's advocate or whatever it is that we're doing here. Like, I love a good debate team energy to a debate, but like, we're not just here to have a good time. It's really not what we're here for.
If you view the primary as Donald Trump is winning by 40 points over everybody else, which he is, then everybody is just here to have a good time. They're all playing for second place.
It depends on who the we is in this. If we is just literally the people on that stage, yes, I suppose it was recreational.
Well, I mean, Vivek he's actually correct about his prospects. He needs entertainment value. He's in... outsider, I will throw anything to the wall that sticks, especially blanket insults against the entire stage here in ways that will guarantee me 30-second response times afterwards. So he needs entertainment. That is a demonstrated avenue to get affection and strange new respect from a swath of not just the Republican electorate, but from a not insignificant number of the libertarians in my Twitter feed, I would say as well. It's very exciting when someone says, you know, they're all bought and paid for and they worship their Pope Zelensky, which I thought was a particularly crass take that was guaranteed to quicken some pulses and sort of demonstrates the long trolling moment that we're not anywhere close to getting out of. I'd predicted ahead of time that Vivek would try to deliberately get under the skin, particularly of Mike Pence and Nikki Haley, and then make the debate all about him. I didn't necessarily think he'd be so successful at it, or at least that the other guys would be, just be vibrating with visible anger toward him. Christie just absolutely wanted to punch him in the teeth, in his gleaming white young person teeth. And I, you know, the thing about people who do that, they can be super great fun when they're on your side. It is super. I loved it when Ramaswamy was like, let's abolish, I don't know, the FBI and the Department of Education and a bunch of other stuff. He's the only one out there being that kind of extremist. And I like that kind of extremist. That is super fun. And then you realize, oh, yeah, he wants to trade the voting rights of young people for mandatory or for national service of some sort until they're 25. What the hell does that mean? And even when he is kind of like emotionally, directionally correct, like, you know, was talking about the malign influence that teachers unions have on American politics and policy, which is absolutely true and something that we've all written about quite a bunch here just on this panel. But abolishing teachers unions, how does the president get to abolish teacher? What is the mechanism for that?
Break, actually, which was even more. Like, he just said they were going to break the union.
I mean,
like emotionally?
You can break a... Ronald Reagan broke the...
Strike. You can break a strike. You can't break a...
I mean,
I don't know.
Who knows? But, like, and there's this feeling people get excited about that. They like that type of absolutely unworkable, super preternaturally confident presentation from an outsider who has absolutely no applicability about how this is going to work. This still thrills people. And as long as it thrills people, you know, you're going to have some fun disappointments going forward. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obvious that he watched the Donald Trump or read the Donald Trump playbook from 2016, right? And he's trying to like update it and use it in his own way. But it's the same thing. It's like the build the wall theory, right? That was a simple, concise solution to immigration that wasn't a solution at all and was completely unworkable and very expensive, but people latched onto it. And I think you see that with a lot of what Vivek's talking about. The other thing that struck me is like he's got this, you sort of alluded to it, Matt, he's got this idea that like American citizens should have to pass a civics test before they're allowed to vote. But then in other answers, you know, he says things like, well, we have to break the teachers' unions, which of course is not something that the federal government can do. Maybe a school district or a state would be in better position to do that, but not the federal government. And he also seemed to suggest at one point that like the vice president has the ability to change the voting laws for the entire country, like as that was his solution to what we should do on January 6th was like, well, Mike Pence should have just changed the voting laws for all the places and made them better. And it's like, well, that's OK. That's not how that works at all. Like the vice president is actually not the world's most powerful politician. In fact, quite the opposite. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I would love to know what that civics exam would look like. And I would love to see him take it before he tries to make the rest of us do it.
Yeah, he's attempted to sort of clarify those remarks over the weekend on Meet the Press and other chat shows. And it is an absolute dog's breakfast of incoherence. It's like, well, if I was Mike Pence, I would push the magic button in certifying the election.
Sure.
Before certifying the election, I would have rewritten electoral laws. That's not hard. Come on. Anyone can do it. All right. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. We've alluded to him before, Donald Trump. Takeaways from the Tucker interview and or Trump's policy proposals last week. Catherine, you start us off.
I absolutely hate to just do vibes commentary, but I feel like the only thing that I got off of the chunk of the Tucker interview that I watched was vibes. Like it was low energy, to borrow a term. And I don't know what exactly the plan, like he accomplished the goal, I guess, of like, I am too good for y'all. Like he clearly projected, I am too good for y'all. And so kudos to him on that. But the certainly no news was made. Certainly no information was gleaned. And it wasn't very interesting viewing. And maybe I've forgotten, but I feel like generally Trump talking to the camera provides interest. And this was just very, very bland and very, very dull. Like I didn't learn anything, I don't think.
Eric, I presume you were excited about Trump's 10% tariff proposal.
Yeah. Yeah. Real excited about that. No, not at all. Yeah, this is for anybody who hasn't been, you know, steeped in trade policy stuff or being on Twitter the last week or so. Donald Trump suggested last week that we should have a 10% tariff. This wasn't in the Tucker interview. This was an interview he did on Fox Business, actually, just before the Tucker interview, that we should have a 10% tariff to put a ring or a collar around the country is how he described it. I think he meant to say a ring around the country, but it would actually put like a collar on the economy. Like it would like choke out and put significant federal control over the American economy. Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible idea. Every economist that has commented on this has said it's a bad idea. And also one of those things that you feel like it's just like so many other Trump ideas. It's just one of those things he tossed off without having thought through at all and will probably has already forgotten about. But then again, of course, some of the things that he talked about in the last campaign that seemed like they were just tossed off terrible ideas, like 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, those things came to pass and actually did drive up costs for American businesses and consumers in mostly unseen ways, but very real ways. And that's what this, you know, the idea of putting a 10% tariff on all imports would do too. I mean, like that's going to just, you know, literally everything that comes into the country would now be maybe not 10% more expensive, but somewhere between like 5 to 7% more expensive, depending on what the existing tariffs are. And that's like that's a significant tax increase. I think it was Erica York, I think, at the Tax Foundation. I could be wrong about that. So I'm sorry if I'm miscrediting that. But I think she mentioned that this would be the largest tax increase that any president has proposed in a campaign since like LBJ or something like that, going back to the 60s. So this is, you know, a not insignificant detail and something that Trump should be pressed on more when other people get him, you know, get him to sit down in front of cameras. Tucker, to my knowledge, did not ask him at all about this, which is pretty much, you know, that sums up pretty much the way the Tucker interview went. It was not really a hard-hitting interview by any means.
Zach, what takeaway did you have from Trump's, let's say, the non-criminal side of Trump's last week?
Well, I think just doing a Tucker interview instead of engaging in the debate, I understand the point that, you know, you're trying to put yourself above the fray or as the presumptive nominee. But in the big scheme of things, I think it's a sign of real weakness that and I'm disturbed by this tendency among our politicians to shirk debate or think that they don't have to answer. I mean, even when it happened during the previous election where you saw very little of Biden during that election, I don't even have to engage. I think that you know, this election, this primary, to some degree, really is about: do you believe that Donald Trump is fit to continue to be president or not? And clearly, he and his fans do think that. There's some people on that debate stage that made it clear that they do not think that. There's some people on that debate stage, like Vivek Ramaswamy, who seems to almost be acting as a surrogate or a fan, a Trump fanboy. And then there's Ron DeSantis, who, you know, for all the criticisms that were just levied at Vivek Ramaswamy, and I agree with those, I think the positive aspect of him and the way he speaks is that he answers questions directly, and you kind of come away at the end of his answer with an understanding of a very clear understanding of where he stands. You know, to have kind of Trump's main challenger on stage, who could be running on his record in Florida, you know, dodging and weaving and saying, like, I kind of like have no beef with Mike Pence and what he did, but I'm just gonna like tiptoe around this. Like, that doesn't work for me, and I suspect that doesn't work for a lot of people who are trying to make this decision. So I think that elephant in the room is just not really being addressed straight on, and it's a huge problem.
I hesitate to go into pure kind of practicality matters, but I think it does say something about both the GOP electorate and what Ron DeSantis is doing, is that he is the only candidate who is not a pure political outsider, who has shown any ability to attract Trump voters in this election. And so that's going to put him in this, what seems to us, all of whom are, I think, not Republican voters in the Republican primary, it is self-evidently awkward and painful. Like his little smiles, that he got memed a lot afterwards, after the debate. And he preliminarily has gone up in the polls after the debate, particularly in Iowa, I think in part because there has been a demonstrated ability for Trump voters to go in between, to and from DeSantis and Trump. Back when the first of the four indictments, the bad one in New York, the really bad one, I should say, in New York, the Alvin Bragg one, should not have been brought, as we've discussed previously on this podcast. At the moment that that came out, the spread in the polling between Trump and DeSantis was 15 percentage points. Trump had 45 consistently, and DeSantis had 29 or 30. And overnight, that went to 30 percentage points because all of it went from DeSantis. He lost 7.5. All of it went to Trump. He gained 7.5, and it has stayed there pretty much ever since. It's possible for some of those Trump voters to dribble back over in the direction of DeSantis. And part of the way he does that, one presumes, is by being super awkward for the rest of us to watch. And we should always think in terms of, you know, the consumer driven aspect of politics. I think that is just where Republicans are at right now. You cannot run a specifically, very explicitly anti-Trump campaign, I don't think, as an elected official and win. He'll probably have to sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait before he can take the knives out. And it's going to lead to a lot of awkwardness. All right. Speaking of awkwardness, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, do you ever feel like you're lost in the fog, or at least working your daily responsibilities despite feeling a little hazy around the brainal area? It's a word. The captain of the ship of you just cannot go full speed ahead when you're weighted down with a certain emotional heaviness, or so bewildered by life's rich pageant of challenges that you can't see straight. Therapy with a trusted and professional third-party interlocutor is a way to cut through the mental and emotional clutter so that you can reopen the throttle on life. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this here podcast. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy be your own mental defogger with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Reminder to please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This missive, which has been edited both for length and to protect Catherine's delicate lady ears, comes from old pal John Mozina. Sorry to gender that one, Catherine. Who writes, federal prosecutors recently announced that former Anaheim, California Mayor Harry Singh Sidhu, great name, will plead guilty to one count of obstruction of justice, one count of wire fraud, and two counts of making false statements to federal agents after he was bribed by, quote, people working for the Angels, unquote, that's a baseball team, with a promise of $1 million in future campaign contributions to give the Anaheim Angels access to confidential city government information and help them land a sweetheart stadium deal. I keep waiting for the tipping point where sports team owners will finally go too far and cause a meaningful backlash against increasingly ridiculous stadium subsidies, but it didn't happen with the Angels. It didn't happen with John Fisher's decade-long screw job of A's fans in Oakland, maybe decades. It didn't happen with $1.2 billion in stadium subsidies in Baltimore, or a $1 billion stadium in Buffalo, or a $1.25 billion stadium in Nashville. This, then, is my question for you. What the hell is it going to take? What would it have to look like for some sports team owner to go too far, at least in the non-Dan Snyder category? Dan Snyder was the hated owner of the Washington Redskins football team. I know that when voters get a say, they tend to vote these deals down, as they did recently in Tempe and Albuquerque. But overall, the price tags just keep getting bigger and more ridiculous. How bad will the hubris have to get before we finally see a real backlash? Eric, you've written about this stuff before. What say you?
Yeah, this is an ongoing fight. I don't think there's ever going to be that tipping point. I think it's that you have to win these battles in every locality where they are fought all the time. Like, there's no such thing as, like, there's not going to be a national moratorium on public financing for stadiums, right? That's not realistic. There's not going to be any sort of decision point where we as a country come together and say, no, sports billionaires, you will not get taxpayer money for your next stadium. This is a thing that will just keep happening. And there's more awareness of it now, I think, than ever before, thankful to the work that we've done at Reason, but also thanks to Neil DeMouse at Field of Schemes. That blog is fantastic. Everybody listening to this podcast should check that out and keep it on your regular rotation just to get you angry in the morning, because he does a great job of documenting this stuff. And in the media in general, there's more awareness of this and more coverage of this. But I think in part because there's more awareness of it and because voters have shown a willingness to vote these projects down, you also have more of this happening in a quote unquote black market to some extent, right? Which is what you saw in Anaheim, where you had this potentially illegal deal, apparently illegal deal being made for campaign contributions in exchange for stadium support. A similar thing, not anything that ran afoul of federal law as far as we know, but a similar kind of backroom deal happened in Atlanta a few years ago. The Braves got their brand new stadium out in Cobb County, way outside the city. And that whole thing was negotiated behind closed doors with the county commissioners up there, almost all of whom, I think, or at least a few of them, lost their next reelection bid because the voters were so mad about how that went down. But of course, that doesn't get the voters their money back. The stadium was still built, cost $1 billion in public money, something like that. And you're going to see more of those kind of backroom deals because of the fact that there's awareness and opposition to it when these things come out into the light. So, but it's going to keep happening. There's no tipping point. Baltimore wants more money for refurbishments now. Kansas City, the Royals just released two different stadium renderings last week to try and create a hey, public, let's have you vote between the two so that it's not a new stadium versus old stadium thing. It's which new stadium would you like to have? Don't think about the old one that you already have. That's lovely. So, no, it'll just keep happening.
That's hopeful. Zach, your previous state of California, ironically, and despite the Angels debacle and the A's debacle, is it's arguably the best state in the country when it comes to stadium subsidies, in that at least we have a couple fully privately built stadia there, whatever they call Pac Bell these days, where AT&T Park, I guess, in San Francisco, baseball stadium, and SoFi Stadium in LA for football, have been privately done. And they're all, weirdly enough, they're really great places to watch sporting events. Florida is not so great necessarily about this. Do you have any reflections on how California at least got halfway decent, and or do you have any suggestions for how to, some other steps that can be taken to blunt this? Because it has been depressingly common for more than 30 years now.
Yeah, I don't have much insight on why California versus Florida have done it private versus public, but I will say that this is an incredibly difficult thing to break. For anyone who's ever, which I know includes everyone on this podcast, has read Virginia Postrel's Power of Glamour and understands that glamour, the way these things are sold, the renderings go out and they get printed in the newspaper and people see the big shiny thing and they can imagine all the great economic effects that are going to come from that. And it's all in your imagination, but what your imagination does not create is all of the costs, the bad contracts that are made with politically connected actors. And I think it's only going to get worse, unfortunately, because we have seen downtowns in a decline for years, and that only got worse with the pandemic. And this is the way that politicians try to bootstrap and revive a downtown. It's like, we'll revive the stadium, or we'll build a new stadium, and then all this great stuff is going to go around it. And it's just, when it's public money on the line, it's never done in a way that is cost effective or even has profit as, I don't even know if it's in the top three, considerations, but certainly not the top consideration. This is going to, ultimately generate a return. And so, yeah, I'm like Eric, pessimistic that this problem is going to be turned around anytime soon.
One of the projects that John, letter writer, mentioned in Baltimore, was kind of the first of the new wave of baseball stadium building 30 years ago, directly influenced, by the way, by the movie Field of Dreams. Go read everything that we've written about, especially me. But those stadium projects, which were built with huge amounts of subsidies, tax breaks, and whatnot, were sold as downtown revival projects, all of them. I think Petco Park in San Diego is the one that comes closest to remote plausibility that it was cost effective, and it just wasn't. Please.
Oh, let me just answer your question. Also, the listener's question, Matt, which is what would go too far? I think it's literally bankruptcy. Like, that's, you know, what went too far. You know, I covered Stockton, California when it went bankrupt, and part of why it went bankrupt was they spent all this money on a, it wasn't a stadium, but it was like a, you know, a, like a river walk or a, you know, lakefront walk. And, you know, at that point, when you're going bankrupt and can't pay all your obligations, then you have no choice. But it's hard. Unfortunately, like, I don't see anything other than that, like, severe outcome stopping this stuff.
The Baltimore project, Camden Yards, which is a lovely stadium. But these stadiums, especially when they're built by taxpayers, they try to come back for more 30 years later, like, it's old, man. We got to build a new one or like completely redo it. And so the owner of the Baltimore Orioles, I think John Angelos now, not Peter Angelos, has the cojones to come back and say, we need $1 billion with a B because we're really going to usher in a new era of not just public-private partnership, but of revitalizing downtown. It's like, bro, you just sold it 30 years ago on the same damn thing. But this, watch for this. It's happening everywhere because all the stadiums that were built in this 90s stadium boom are being now resold to the taxpayers again at a higher cost on that argument. Catherine, you have to say something by contract, but also corporate welfare, bad. What's a way to make it go away or to make it harder to pull off?
Yeah, so the way that I was able to engage with this question is that I just pretended it was about spaceports because the dynamics are the same, but then I care. Yeah. And, you know, the dynamics are the same. So, you know, Spaceport America in New Mexico, which has been a boondoggle for a long time. You know, 2017, the revenues were $12 million and 80% of that came from the government. This is a pattern with a lot of space infrastructure. And like, I want, you know, I assume the way I feel about spaceports is the way people feel about sports stadiums, which is like, I want them. I like them. I like the romance of them. I would like one to be near me because that would be cool. But I would not like to pay for it to the tune of millions and millions and millions of dollars without a viable prospect for it to become self-sustaining eventually. To the listener's question, I've said it before on this podcast. I will say it again. Things never get bad enough that people wake up in the morning libertarian. It does not happen. We have to use a different strategy because it never gets bad enough that people say, maybe we should do fiscal discipline and let individuals make their own choices, unfortunately. We have to sell that as an upside. We can't sell it as what happens after the disaster.
Yes to all of that. And also, I was just at the Baltimore Orioles Stadium 2 weeks ago, literally. And it's a lovely place still. It's a lovely facility. It does not need $800 million or whatever it is in upgrades. Beautiful spot. But also, when you get like two blocks away from the stadium into downtown Baltimore, there's not a whole lot of revitalization going on. So like, the atmosphere at the stadium is great. It's really wonderful that that team is doing so well this year. Go Orioles. But like, the you know, if you ever like just go there and walk around a bit, you see the fallacy of this whole argument.
I think
you
want to
know what a like gross not baseball person I am. The only baseball feels I have any bone anywhere in my body is I did grow up in the DC area, and so our team was the Orioles back in the day, and I have like a skosh of warm feeling for that stadium, for Camden Yards, and for, I'm so sorry, Cal Ripken. That's it. That's all I have. And I've been reliably informed that that's like worse than nothing. But that's what I have for you.
No,
and I think part of the answer is just to show people over and over what can happen. It's almost, you know, like exposure therapy. Like, you know, the the project in Wisconsin, the you know, Trump and Scott Walker worked together to like try to attract this huge manufacturing facility from Foxconn. It was going to be the biggest, greatest, you know, LCD
manufacturing. The eighth wonder of the world.
The eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah.
In Racine, Wisconsin. And it's like there's one building there that I think there's a, you know, a couple janitors that work in it at this point. And the town just gave all this land away and all these tax breaks and what amount to subsidies. And so if you can just kind of show people the failed eighth wonders of the world over and over again, maybe that will slowly shift opinion away from or at least increase skepticism going forward.
Here's what I think, and I'm thinking out loud, so God help America. But, you know, in a similar way that Ron DeSantis during COVID took measures that felt a little bit heavy-handed, like all schools must stay open. Like, do we want the governor to do that? We want to be local. I like the result of that action of what he did. And then he also said, like, you know, cruise ships can't do vaccine requirements,
vaccine mandates.
Didn't like that one because it was too heavy-handed, right? I think the, you know, the Alex of the world, that's the American something or others, should be working on model legislation to figure out a way to either like on the state level, say you're a state like California, like Florida, that actually has self-confidence, unlike Oregon or something. And you, by which I mean, like, the worst cities for this are cities that want to have desperately major leagues stadia for whatever they have, because they're not quite there. Portland only has really one professional team in the big three, which is the basketball team. So they like will throw all the money at like soccer stadiums. It's just awful. Anyways, but on the state level, say, okay, you cannot by law, have any subsidy money for stadium projects unless it passes a voter plebiscite, you know, and you can even make the threshold high, or you can just make it 50%, because most of the time if people vote on this, they're going to vote against it once they see how much they're going to have to pay for it. The problem with all these things is that there are all these backroom deals, and I take it granted that voters just don't get to vote on stuff in most places or in all places through ballot initiatives, but there needs to be some kind of creative, like, perhaps overbroad or stiff type of approach to this, because Lord knows the attempts to use creative lawsuits and constitutionality, they didn't work, which we've written about. We've written about every single one of these attempts over the years. We've been engaged with Field of Schemes, has the great economist J.C. Bradbury, who we've interviewed over the years, and who's got a wonderful and very rancid Twitter follow about this. Write about it over and over and over again, and it's not working. And right now is the moment, right? This is the hinge point because of all these aforementioned projects that are happening. I want there to be a limited government outfit out there who's figuring out and testing out on the state level semi-heavy-handed ways to at least make it more difficult for local politicians to cut ribbons. And if you want to expand it beyond baseball state, great. Convention center, great. Vote on it.
So
do it.
This is the same approach that a lot of libertarians have had to come to terms to with zoning, where, you know, we... Yep. A lot of us, you know, favor local control whenever possible, or like decentralize the decision making down to the lowest political level possible. But then at some point, these cities like Los Angeles, where I spent 15 years, become these little fiefdoms. Like each city council member is like, a real estate agent or something. And at some point, I don't know, just having a state law that says stop doing that, it becomes very tempting, to say the least.
Yes. All right. We're getting near the end here, but I wanted to make sure we hit this, perhaps in lightning round form. It is back to school week in many parts of the country, including in my house, which means the now annual tradition of mainstream media scare stories about resurging COVID counts in schools and various other mitigation measures that are either still in place or being considered for reanimating from the dead. These policies are in play. Last week, Reason's Emma Camp had a piece about how dozens of colleges are still enforcing vaccine mandates, partying like it's 2021 or whatever. We got some parents on this here podcast, at least a couple. Catherine, what are you seeing, if anything, anecdotally about resurgent COVID style mandates and policies and restrictions in schools or around the people around you?
So the DC public schools were some of the very last schools to still require testing to return after breaks. And I will be interested to see. They did not, I do not believe there is a requirement to start the school year to test in, but I will be interested to see if those come back in the, you know, as the weather gets colder and somebody starts coughing somewhere in the nation's capital. I did go and check out the CDC's updated recommendations out of curiosity. And one thing that struck me is while there is an explicit rejection now of test to stay policies because they require quarantine for exposure, which is no longer the guidance, they do still have the guidance to clean all surfaces at least once a day. And when you click through, the guidance does say basically like shampoo the carpets every day, which, I mean, it might actually be a good idea in like an elementary school classroom to shampoo the carpets every day because children are disgusting. But that is not a COVID mitigation technique that we should be pursuing, nor is it practical. It's just a good example of how, you know, these official guidelines have become background noise. And that's unfortunate because it would be nice if there was some kind of entity that existed in the nation that could give like non-binding but helpful information about public health crises that people trusted. Too bad about that.
Zach, you live in the free state of Florida. I presume there's not a single restriction anywhere around you about anything.
Your presumption is 100% correct, and it makes me feel good. It makes me feel like I made the right decision. And I encourage anyone who is, you know, facing this for the upcoming school year to, you know, do, if you can't buy a plane ticket to Florida, then at least, you know, figure out some way to just do what you want. We need to get these people the hell out of our lives as much as possible. You know, one of the worst things about the COVID years and the Trump years was just having politicians take up everyone's mind space constantly and dictate how we try to live our lives. And part of that, you know, comes, you know, a big part of it is on them, but some of it is on, you know, us as individuals as well to try to design our lives as much as possible, not to have to listen to them or deal with it.
Eric, you hate kids, but you also hate government too. So do you see anything out there with lingering COVID mania?
Yeah, I mean, this is, being that this is a lightning round, I'll just say that like pretty much all other aspects of the back to school period, the COVID stuff now makes me just even more certain that I never want to have children because it just seems insane. Like, and even before COVID stuff, it seems like all the back to school stuff is crazy. Yeah, I can't imagine dealing with this. I know somebody who like has to, you know, take their kid like in and out of daycare every week because if the kid has like an allergic reaction and gets like red eyes, then that they have to throw them out of the daycare program or something for a few days until they get tested for COVID. They can't come back. It just seems like the number of hoops we've put in front of parents is ridiculous. So yeah, I don't know. I hope there's this there's this new variant, I guess, that's out there now, and there's this sort of rumbling about maybe the return of mask mandates or something. And I cannot handle this. Like, I do not want to go through all that again. So I don't know. Fingers crossed that that's not going to happen, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. My hat is off to you, I guess, parents. I don't know what the right phrase is, but good luck.
Here in the People's Republic of Brooklyn, I haven't seen much in the way of advisements, rules, restrictions, get the mask back on stuff, partly because I don't necessarily read every one of the emails from the public schools that my kids used to go to. One of the last ones that I read was like, let's participate in the anti-fossil fuels march. It's like, all right, how's that whole like, you know, math gap coming? But anyways, yeah, so it doesn't seem to be as heavy in the air. Where it is heavy is still in the media. And that's where I'm watching with some interest New York Times reporter, Apoorva Mandavilian, I'm sorry for pronouncing her name badly, who really has written a lot of disgraceful stuff about COVID over the years and should have been taken off the beat. And I don't usually say that about every reporter at all, but has like made a lot of errors. Had a piece just a day or two ago that sort of framed the debate as that, you know, Republicans during the presidential campaign are bringing this up. They're sort of like trying to, you know, Republicans are pouncing on COVID in schools again. Also, you know, we wouldn't have had to do all those school closures if we just done all the ventilation. And oh, by the way, the $160 billion that the federal government gave basically to do the ventilation didn't do any ventilation because they spent it on other stuff. And this is just a wonderful little mini paragraph. She blames this on, quote, a lack of clear federal guidance on cleaning indoor air. No senior administration official designated to oversee such a campaign. Few experts to help the schools spend the funds wisely. Supply chain delays for new equipment and insufficient staff to maintain.
I love the imagery of one federal official overseeing every school redoing their AC system.
Imagine the ventilations are. Like, imagine the nonsense of that office. They pay like, you know, $500,000 for like a mascot that's just like a HEPA filter with legs and like googly eyes.
Stop it. It's going to happen if you keep doing this. All right. Let's go to our end of podcast. What we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, you start.
I watched season 2 of Good Omens, which I, as listeners to this podcast may recall, absolutely love. The book Good Omens, a novel co-written by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, two of my faves. And the first series I approached with tremendous trepidation because I was concerned that it would take a beloved book and turn it into hot garbage. But in fact, I thought that the series was very good. Season 2 is not very good. Season 2 is kind of rambly. It's basically fan fiction. It's just like a bunch of fan fiction about the Good Omens characters. And if you are going to watch this, please mute yourself now because I am going to do spoilers. The only real reason takeaway that I could get from the series is in the final episode when Zirafil, who is an angel, who has been on Earth a little too long and gone native, is offered the job of boss of heaven, and his friend, shall we say, Crowley, who is a demon, says, are you kidding me? Of course you turned that garbage job down. And Aziraphale says, no, but if I'm in charge, I can make a difference. And I did have some libertarian feels about that, because the heaven of Good Omens is a bureaucratic, stupid, silly place. And the hopefulness of this character that if he's in charge, he can make a difference, really, really hits hard, especially when you have his beloved Crowley sitting there saying, here's an alternate proposal. Let's run away together to Alpha Centauri. I'm going to hold open the possibility that a third season will show that there were wheels within wheels and that Aziraphale has a secret plan. All of that is just to say, as always, the demons are more appealing than the angels, perhaps in all of fiction, certainly in Good Omens.
I watched Silo on the recommendation of our colleague Natalie Dowzicki, who reviewed it for the magazine, and now I'm left twisting in the wind because production shut down with the Hollywood strikes, so I feel compelled to read the series of novellas it's based on. First one's called Wool. I'm not going to go into it at length because I know Peter's talked about it on a previous podcast, but it is just a really gripping portrayal of a completely socially engineered society and the lies and deception needed to keep it going and the resulting effects on people living under those conditions. So those themes might be of interest to our audience. And production-wise, just incredible set designs, writing, some really good performances, especially from the lead actress, and just overall really pleased that shows like this are being made. It's on Apple TV, and hope the writers and actors get a deal done so I can get on to season two. I might have to join the picket line to get that done, but Silo.
Awesome. Eric, what did you consume?
I went to see Sleep No More a couple weekends ago in New York City. This is a immersive theatrical experience. And I think I said this about the thing that I saw the last time I was a guest on this podcast, but one of the coolest theatrical experiences of my life, something I would absolutely recommend. It's in a converted warehouse in Chelsea that's all decked out to look like an old hotel. And the story that you're told as you're like checking into this hotel for the show is that this was abandoned for decades and it's recently been restored. And there's multiple floors, the first few of which actually do resemble an old hotel. And as you go higher and higher, it gets weirder and weirder. You end up actually in something that looks very much like an old insane asylum by the time you get to the top of it. You're allowed to wander the building freely for 3 hours, and the show just happens around you and the other people that are there as guests. And it's probably the closest thing, I guess, like the libertarian takeaway here is that it's probably the closest thing to Westworld that you could actually experience in real life, because the actors are on loops. They're literally just doing the same. They do three loops through the show, and there's different scenes happening in different rooms on different floors, and the actors are moving between rooms and between floors and in and out of these different scenes, and it's all timed, obviously, so that they can go, you know, people, the characters can interact with each other in the way that the story necessitates. And the only difference is that, unlike in Westworld, you can't actually interact with them. You're not allowed to touch them. You're not allowed to communicate with them at all. In fact, you're not allowed to speak, and all the guests have to wear masks the whole time. So it does create this sense of, like, we're all ghosts kind of watching this play take place in front of us, and we are unable to intervene in it, but we're watching this tragedy unfold. Anyway, it's just really fascinating. You can do kind of what I did, which is just wander around the hotel and take in kind of the ambiance and catch little scenes and enjoy the really specific and really well done kind of set decorations that are there. Or you can follow particular characters through their loops and follow the actual story, which I'm told is sort of a loose adaptation of Macbeth. But I did not do enough of that to actually really fully grasp the whole story. So I got to go back and do it again, I guess. But really just like a fascinating experience, and really just unlike anything else I've ever seen. So very cool. That's Sleep No More in New York City.
Cool. Think I might go check that out. I am going to take advantage of Nick Gillespie's absence on this podcast to talk about a book and a subject that he would just be interrupting about constantly and making horrible noises with his mouth like he does sometimes. The book is called The Band, FAQ. FAQ stands for Frequently Asked Questions, I understand. The subhead is All That's Left to Know About the Fathers of Americana. This is by Peter Aaron, spelled like Hank Aaron. The band is The Band, which was the backup band for Bob Dylan on a couple of tours beginning in the mid-60s and also in the mid-70s. And then they famously did a bunch of basement tapes with him up in the Woodstock Saugerties area in 1967 that became this very kind of famous bootleg source material. After the band's Robbie Robertson died a couple of weeks ago, I've been deep diving into various parts, was driving around up there and went and visited the house where they made did a lot of the basement tapes, the music from The Big Pink, which is the name of their debut album. This is still Pink, the house. At any rate, some bits about that, particularly the way that moment in time of Bob Dylan and the band just kind of woodshedding away from the public glare, and in the process sort of inventing the genre of Americana, or sort of rediscovering it for the rock generation, is something that is of interest for me, despite the fact that both the band and Bob Dylan are two of the most over-covered subjects in rock music and popular entertainment history. You could argue that they're overrated, just like on this side of the Beatles, just like stop talking about them. Yet I had an interest in reading about them, went to the bookstore, just kind of gobbling up everything that was around, looking for Greil Marcus, the great rock critic's you know, Invisible Republic and some of his other things that have been written about the making of the Basement Tapes, could not find them. And so with great reluctance, picked up a book called The Band FAQ, thinking, oh, God, it's going to be one of these things. Like, if you're a baseball fan, I'm just doing this all to make Catherine go to sleep, by the way. And it's been successful. If you're a baseball,
I'm literally just like scrolling Twitter right now. So carry on.
If you're a baseball fan, there's always like, you know, 40 things that every Anaheim Angels fan should know. And you're like, okay, I'll never pick that up because it's just going to be like some trivia mill doing bullet points. This is actually a really good book that is sort of set up with a lot of bullet points. Here are the main characters. Here is, I don't know, Kathy Evelyn Smith, the woman who went to jail for doing the drug cocktail that killed John Belushi. Turns out she was a band groupie as a teenager and had a baby with that they couldn't determine which band member was the father, so they called it the band baby. These kind of details, right? Anyways, see, Catherine woke up. But it's also just a very good book. And I appreciate someone pulling off a genre, a type of book that is almost always terrible and making it really good. If you're interested at all in the subject, Hudson Valley music, the band, Dylan, creation of Americana, it's really solid, called The Band FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Fathers of Americana. Okay, the end. Catherine, yeah, so I have to listen now. If you thank you for listening, everyone. And if you like what we do, go to reason.com/donate. Help us do more of it, like more podcasts, like more special one-off podcasts starring Eric Bain. What's on this week, Eric?
This week, we're doing an episode about the chicken tax. Maybe you've heard of that before. Maybe you haven't. Back in the 1960s, there was a trade war between the U.S. and Europe over frozen chicken, because believe it or not, in the 1960s, chicken was a delicacy in Europe. That's how recent, chicken, now we think of it as this like ubiquitous thing. But there wasn't a lot of it in Europe. There was a trade war over the fact that we were exporting chicken to Europe in response to the tariffs that the Europeans put on. We ended up throwing tariffs on a bunch of European imports, stuff like brandy and pickup trucks. And so this episode is all about how that has warped the pickup truck market. We talked to Jordan Golson, a freelance automotive journalist, and he tells us the fascinating story, the history of the Subaru Brat, which is a pickup truck that had seats installed in the bed of the truck so that it was not a cargo vehicle, but a passenger vehicle, and thus was not subject to tariffs when it was imported here into the United States. Really fascinating story about like the lengths that businesses go to get around tariffs sometimes. Really fun episode. Maybe my favorite episode of the whole series. Why We Can't Have Nice Things. It'll be out this Thursday.
Eric, will this episode feature you debuting your country song, Brandy and Pickup Trucks?
Oh man, I wish. Do we have time to record that? Let's do that. That's what I'm going to spend the rest of the day on today. We'll get
Seems
that
fair.
In it.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Thank you, Eric and Zach, for stepping in admirably. Pretty solid, great work over here. And thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.